Hello, everyone. Welcome to Coaches on the Couch. I'm Rachel Birchmore.
And I'm Louise.
And I'm just here to briefly introduce the podcast for any new listeners out there before we jump into today's conversation. So Louise Rogers, my co-host, and I are both leadership coaches. We work with individuals and teams around sort of in the area of people management, communication, and those broader leadership capabilities and confidence. And we do that through our Step Up programs. And Coaches on the Couch as a podcast explores leadership across the built environment, which is where we specialize and do most of our work. And you'll find over 50 episodes with various leaders on various themes on Apple, Spotify, and other sort of usual podcast platforms. So moving on to today's conversation, today we're speaking with Linda Thiel, who is a partner of architectural practice White. It's worth just a little shout out because we mentioned during the conversation an event that Louise and I hosted with brand strategist and writer Emma Keat called Glue. So just a shout out to Emma there. And that was part of London Festival of Architecture. So let's move into today's conversation. So hi, Linda. Welcome to the virtual couch. Great to see you.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
How are you today?
I'm good. We're good.
Good. Thanks. Brilliant. Well, obviously, before we get into anything else, we need to chat couches. So please tell us something brief and interesting about your couch.
Oh, well, I guess, this is a very big couch. It's actually the one that we have in our Swedish house. And we would never have been able to fit it in our London home. Couldn't even get in through the door, I think. I think it's great because it's really big and wide. And you can actually, it sleeps too comfortably. You can sleep like side by side or head to toe. And we're all very tall in my family. I'm the shortest and I'm 5'10". So we kind of needed a big piece.
Yes.
I sleep easily and I read a lot. And I guess my thing is I love lying on the sofa or couch reading and then falling asleep. I guess
I have to say, it's my skill. Yeah, that's my superpower too. I have a sofa or a couch that's very similar to yours that I do call the sofa of slumber.
Yeah.
Because when I first got it, I didn't seem to be able to sit on it for more than 10 or 15 minutes without having a nap. But there you go.
Yeah. But it's very relaxing and it kind of refreshes your mind and then you can sort of, yeah, you can reflect on things, which is nice.
Right.
So to the business. White was founded in Gothenburg in 1951, which is a whole 72 years ago. It's a long time ago, isn't it? By Sydney White. And has since grown to a collective of over 800 architects. And the practice has a focus on sustainability and innovation, which I'm sure we'll come to. And Linda, you're originally from Sweden and you joined White in 2007, having run your own practice for many years. And you became a partner of White in 2010. And then moved to London in 2015 to set up the London studio, where you're now director. And we understand that your project focus is housing design in urban contexts and sort of bringing a Scandinavian approach to designing homes. And I wondered, because it's hard to kind of think what that means, are there a couple of key projects which really sum up what that means, what, you know, sum up White and your approach to architecture?
I think a couple of projects. I think actually one of the first ones we were commissioned to do when we set up the office was the Climate Innovation District in Leeds for C2.
Right.
And originally we were asked to join them for a meeting to have a look at one or two of the blocks that they had sort of proposed on a small master plan on their sites, South Leeds. And Jeff and I, my colleague, we went up and we had a conversation. We had a really good conversation all day. And basically we said, well, we don't want to design any sort of housing blocks for you. You need to have a proper good site-wide master plan that's actually built on all of the vision that you have for this sustainable neighborhood, which is based on pedestrian, everything that happens in between the buildings and all other things, so that people can actually live the way you aspire to within this innovation district. So I went back on the train and realized, well, that probably was stupid. Say no to, like, you know, 100 units design, just do a master plan. But I think that kind of, and I'd never heard the word red line boundary before, and that was completely new to me. So I was like, what is this artificial red line? What happens in between? And what
not exists?
Reaching beyond the parameters. And I think that's quite telling for how we look at sort of urban design, public realm and landscape-led designs in housing sort of residential projects, which we then were subsequently able to bring on to the projects we've been working on for BeFirst in Birkin on the Gascoigne estate, where we've really pushed those boundaries. And I think in terms of the design of the home, a very Swedish or Scandinavian aspect, it's that it's very rational. It's all MMC, offsite based, sort of on a strict grid, but it's really working with less material and work a lot with daylight and spatial arrangements to make it easy to use and can relax, not so nitty gritty, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah,
but it's been very, I mean, what we do as architects, it's fantastic to be able to work in different contexts, because it's also been a steep learning curve understanding all the aspects of how it's done in the UK and see where we can find the best crossover between the two.
And it's that sort of Scandinavian approach which has brought us to invite you onto the podcast today. We were interested to explore what that might mean in a leadership context.
I wonder if the cultural thing about the collective effort that you've talked about is something that comes into the organization with the people that come into the organization. I suppose what I'm saying is it something that people experience in the wider Scandinavian culture?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is, you can't sort of not acknowledge that it's a Swedish company and that within the Swedish culture, it's so much about the group effort. And I think still today, we start like preschool or kindergarten when we're like 1 year or 2 years old. And it's always about the team and making sure that everyone comes along. There is, you know, no one is the big star. Everyone is the star at whatever point it might be. And I think that's so embedded in many Swedes' upbringing or Scandinavians' upbringing, I think, which might. So it comes very natural to us. And I think the cultural differences are seen when we go into different markets and different countries. So for instance, in the UK, I even noticed, because I can think, well, I was brought up during the 70s and 80s. So that was, you know, very 70s at that time. But even I realized my children had the same thing with them. So my daughter was, she had always been dancing since she was 3 years old, various stuff. And then when we moved to London, she wanted to do street dancing, and I enrolled her in this class, which I afterwards realized was quite sort of a prominent dance school. But she stopped after 6 months. She said, it's horrific. It's like no one is talking to anyone. It's not, they're not there because it's fun. They're there to be standing in the front line at the center to get the next role in the next whatever musical or something. Yeah. And she basically stopped dancing. And my son plays a trombone, and he joined a youth orchestra. And the first question was, which grade do you see? I was like, what is, do you have a grade? He's like playing an instrument. That's for fun. You know, it's enjoyable. And I didn't even know that was a grading system for playing an instrument in the UK. It's just a different thing in terms of, which goes back to what we discussed, who speaks at meetings, or, you know, who takes, you know, various roles, whereas it's everyone can bring something to the team. And it is stronger when you do it as a team. And obviously, as architects, we always work within teams. And it's just, yeah, really trying to work from that holistic view of the team, I think. It takes some works when you work between, you know, different cultures, or you know, wherever people come from in your team. It's trying to establish that foundation, I think.
Yeah. It's the real nub of collaboration, isn't it? Which is a word that people band around so often, but that humility rather than ego, and the, you know, cooperation rather than competition and individual effort is really at the heart of that.
I mean, it's like I tend to ask, I mean, obviously, I can push a team on deadlines as any other leader, I guess. But I also think it's important to ask, you know, you want to deliver something that everyone is proud of in the end. It's not my project. It's like our project. And we need to be proud of what we're doing. And when you start talking about that, people actually realize, well, can I actually just redo this one? Because I don't think it's good enough. Or it's not me always might not even have seen it, but they need to be equally proud of their work and the end results. It's not just one person's pen on the paper.
Very interesting. Thank you. You know, when we spoke briefly before the podcast, you mentioned that at the heart of leadership at White is a sort of flat structure, which always, we actually talked about this yesterday with 70 Health. It always intrigues us because people talk about a flat structure, but when you look at their business and you actually start getting involved in the business, there's evidence of a hierarchy. So we just wondered what that means at White.
Yeah. I mean, this would probably be a whole thesis, but I'll try to do a very short version. I think something that you mentioned in the introduction is the collective of architects. I think that's really important here. And we are fully employee-owned. And as long as you are permanently employed, you are able to buy shares within the company. And if you leave, you have to sell them back to the company. And I think that's part of the how the flat organization works, which means that everyone has a voice. But it, sort of on a daily matter, obviously we do have a CEO and a CFO and sort of a line organization that manages resourcing and making sure that we sort of cover all the projects that we're doing at any given time. But to the teams, I think it the flat organization comes with a lot of responsibility. When I first started at White, I was asking a senior member of a team, well, so how does this work? And, you know, can I just bring in my own clients or who decides what? And, you know, I basically just had to ask because there were so many of us. And he said, well, it's really up to you. You can do whatever you want, but you have to take a lot. It comes with a lot of responsibility and trust. So I think, which also, I guess, can be debated to length exactly what that means. But I think for us, it's letting the team work sort of really integrated together so that they get to know each other and trust each other, so that everyone knows what's going on. I mean, we even do on a quarterly basis, we share all the financial reports with the whole company. So everyone knows what's in the books, basically. So it goes on very many different levels.
Mm. What percentage of people do own shares?
I should know this because we just released the annual report, but I think it's I think we're roughly 750 in the company at the moment, and I think that it's between 550-ish kind of that owns shares, I think 600 maybe.
Okay. And is it something that's talked about? I mean, is there, I suppose I'm thinking, is there ever a kind of, you're either a shareholder or you don't really belong in the same kind of way?
I don't think in that specific context, because everyone is offered to buy shares and they might not for various reasons, or they might, you know, invest in other things. I don't know. Or it's just not time for them at the moment. So I think the non-shareholders and the shareholders, that's not such a big debate, but within the shareholder group, there is sort of the wider shareholder group and the partner group, and the partner group always owns 50% of the shares, or a majority. So I think there's been, over my 15 years at White, it's obviously been various conversations between the two shareholder groups. And most recently, it's actually been discussed whether we should just do all meetings together because we're all shareholders.
Really?
Or if it's important that there is a difference between shareholders and partners, which obviously the partnership comes with more responsibility for others.
I was going to ask you about that, the responsibility that you talked about there, in a slightly different context just then. But when you were saying, you know, this flat structure comes with a lot of responsibility, it's probably the most common thing that comes up for us when we're coaching leaders, when they're struggling to get people who are coming behind them to take ownership and step into that sort of increasing responsibility. How do you achieve that at White?
I mean, it might be, comparing sort of a Swedish context, sort of vastly generalizing, I can't even say the word, sorry.
Generalization.
I think, which kind of also cross over to sort of being Swedish work in the UK context, but I think the group effort is always promoted in most instances across the sort of society. Whereas I think sometimes in other cultures, it's more on an individual basis, but the group and team effort being very important also means that you have to get to know the team members. You need to be very much, basically as the leader, you need to share all the information to enable everyone to actually make informed decisions, to be able to take responsibility. So we discuss the program, we discuss, is this resourcing rights? You know, I would have discussions with the team. Well, you're given too low fee for this. We can't deliver within this time frame. We need to sort of renegotiate. We need to reassess the scope, or how are we going to make this work? That's not just, I mean, in the end of the day, it's kind of my responsibility. But having the conversation with everyone involved actually also enables them to understand where to put their effort and actually be able to work on the right task at the right time, which is generally quite difficult to figure out, I think. I mean, in our team meetings, we don't only talk about the project. It's also about how it's run and what's working and if we have the right information to enable people to work properly.
And because you obviously London office has some really great projects. Presumably you recruit people who have trained here. I know you have a very international staff. I'm just wondering what somebody would notice. What would their experience being of joining White if they'd worked for a similar sized UK owned and run practice?
I mean, I think sort of responses that we get is that they're quite shocked when we share all the financial results and data, and that we share so much information about how we work and how we run the projects. I guess if you had worked in a practice with 25, 30 people owned by two owners, they might keep a lot to themselves and just sort of, you know, it's kind of common solution anywhere, I guess. Whereas we also have quite sort of engaged bid meetings where we discuss which projects we should bid or tender for, or which competitions we should do. We have our one benefit of being employee owned is that we reinvest a lot of money in research. So we also encourage everyone in the staff to actually be involved in our knowledge networks and research networks. So I think that kind of, and people tend to, when we do interviews and they want to work with us, it's like most of them say, well, I applied to work with you because I want to learn more about what you do, or I really think that your sustainability ethos is, you know, aiming really high and I want to be a part of that and I want to contribute. I want to learn more to be able to contribute. So it's a very, which I guess, I mean, in many architecture offices, but it's, to me, I get just a feeling that it's very value-based, where kind of going back to the sort of Swedish long negotiations and common grounds, like once we've sort of discussed things to death, we are on the same route to somewhere. But that whole conversation can take a very long time, but it's also very, very good because you twist and turn and you get a lot of input. And once you kind of know where you're going, everyone is moving in that direction.
I'm curious about the impact of sharing financials because, you know, I've been a small business owner. On the one hand, you know, it's great when things are going really well, but if things aren't going so well, people might start getting itchy feet and thinking, I better, you know, think about getting out because there might not be a job here. Or do you know what I mean? I'm totally with you. I think it's have that open approach to sharing that kind of information. But what is the impact of that? How do people respond to that?
I mean, I think it is part of everyone being a shareholder. So they want, I mean, they have the right to know and they want to know. I think there is an element of stress factor, definitely, when they see that all numbers aren't great in all the offices. But there is also very sort of interesting and nice joint up commitment to support sort of various offices that might struggle. Or we have 14 offices, so, and they're, although 11 or 12 of them are in Sweden, it's still sort of various markets within Sweden. And then we have Oslo, London, Stuttgart, and Nairobi. So generally, the different offices have been able to support each other. Or, okay, but we might have a lot to do, but we don't have to recruit, because then we can bring in people from the other offices to work on our projects to support. And then it's kind of push, you know, kind of help each other out. And I think that also brings all these 750, 800 people together, not just the individual offices. I mean, it can also be speaking from our own experience, it can be very exhausting working in a very flat organization and in a very big organization where so much information is shared, because you can also drown in. Yeah, for some people, it can definitely be too much. And then I think it's from a leader's point of view, it's also being able to acknowledge that and say, well, you don't have to worry about it. You can just do this bit, which is also really important today or this week or this year. Or don't worry, just take your parental leave time off, because family always comes first.
Yeah, that must be a difficult balance. I mean, I'm thinking the time factor in here as well. I mean, one of the things that we hear a lot, and I was coaching somebody last week who's trying to shift his leadership style within a larger organization to something more akin to what you're describing. And he was talking about the amount of time that it takes to be more open and to ask more questions rather than tell people what to do. I mean, what advice would you give to somebody like that? How do you make that work?
And I totally understand. I've been there myself many, many times. I think you need to know yourself really well, and also, which is very difficult. I don't know how many times myself, whereas people sort of, you hit the wall and you realize, I can't take this anymore. It's just too much. And you kind of just feel like, I just want to tell this person to do exactly this and nothing else, and don't ask any questions. But someone once told me, just step back, take a breath, go out for 5 minutes, come back, and just do it gentle. And, you know, you're not going to be on your, show all your best sides every day. And I think that's also part of really knowing your team. And there are many conversations when you do sort of leadership courses, like, am I going to be personal but not private? You know, how much of myself do I show my team? And do I show when I'm vulnerable or not? And I think that's a really tricky balance. I always thought that I was very sort of, had a really sort of strict surface and didn't want to be private at all. But I also realized, I've been doing this for a long time, it feels, when I talk about it, but like a few decades. But you also realize that it is, you have to show that sometimes, because everyone has those sides. And if you don't, it might be easier for your team to push back really hard. And we're all people and we have to be able to cope. Sometimes I think it's also fine for a leader to say, okay, I hear you, but let's continue this another day. Or
yeah,
because they don't always know that you have. I mean, it's a classic. We don't always know what's behind or what's going on with the other person.
No,
they
absolutely.
Might have like a million other things going on, and it might not just be the right time. So I think just being a bit gentle with people, I think, is
enough to show you're human.
Yeah.
I think the advice to step out, take a couple of breaths, and then go back in gently. I just wanted to repeat that, because that's such good advice for all sorts of situations, isn't it?
Works at home as well, but I don't do it as well at home, I guess.
Yeah. Linda, we saw you last week at our glue event.
Oh, yes, that was great. It's a really good event. Yeah.
Thank you. But there was a question there which we didn't quite get time to discuss with you and a couple of the other international practices in the room, but we were just for the listeners' benefit who weren't at the event, the glue, we were talking about what brings people together and what keeps people together. And we were interested, beyond the discussion in the room, which was as deep as it could go in the hour that we had, we were trying to think, what is it in an international organization? How does that glue stretch between offices? You know, how do you make that work between the different offices?
Between Canada and Nairobi and
I mean, it is obviously hard work, but I also think that it's also hard work between our Swedish offices, but even more so with the international, because the Swedish offices have, you know, they're like the mothership. They have very, you know, seamless language. We've been working over the last 10 years to kind of turn the whole company to have English as the company, like, sort of business language, which obviously is difficult when the majority of the people are Swedish and work in Sweden with Swedish clients. But also making sure that we include all of our international colleagues and international offices. But one thing that we've been doing, I think actually Sid started this back in 51, was to have these, which I mean, a lot of offices do. We do the study trips. We don't do them every year anymore, but we do them roughly every other year. And instead of going office by office, we mix across the whole company. So that gives everyone a really good opportunity to actually meet people from other offices and people that you don't work with, might be working on completely different types of projects. And everyone comes back over those 4 days being so totally refreshed and having met so many new friends and having learned so much about the company. And I think that's really important. It was actually mentioned in the Glue event last week, you know, like eating together or actually doing things together and having those conversations face to face are really, really important. And I think that was something that we also experienced during COVID when we couldn't meet. And our annual meetings, you can imagine 800 people at one big event. It's not like the WeWork summer camps, but you know, it's kind of they're also always big events when everyone comes together. We couldn't do that for 2 years. And then I think this year even we did it online, but with offices in their various cities together. And I think it's so important that we're able to bring that back and actually see each other face to face, not to be underestimated. But then we have all these online forums and we have our research networks on different topics where people get involved. We work really hard on that sort of creative collective and we're actually, you know, really trying to make sure that the creative collective ethos enables us to do better projects that really makes a difference. So I think that's, and when we share those successes, I think everyone becomes really proud and realize how important it is.
And linked to that sort of Glue thing, you mentioned at the beginning of that answer, you said Sid, presumably you were referring to Sydney White.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Sydney White, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but I'm thinking 72 years, you know, that's such a, I'm wondering what kind of glue and collective ethos comes from him, like 72 years ago, the legacy of a founder. And I believe the company was set up as an EOT from the beginning.
Yes, yeah.
So that legacy really continues. It's quite unusual, isn't it, to have that longevity of legacy.
But I think what I think and sort of how the story is generally told and, you know, being, you know, discussed, you know, from time to time, but we keep coming back to the same thing is that it's grown the whole company from when they started in 51. They won a really big housing competition straight after university. It's really been a architectural practice that has sort of grown alongside society. So it's grown from working lots with housing and urban design, healthcare, working really hard with the well-being and social aspects of people being together, living together or working together. And then from that sort of grown and building on various other sectors. And I think that sort of really strong ethos is something that carries the company and has carried the company. And even looking back at these old projects that's been done by sort of former colleagues, some where we even go back and sort of retrofit kind of our own projects, you might say. I think that history is also quite important for people. They know that this is a company that's been along for a very long time and keep doing sort of projects within this social ethos. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does.
I'm just thinking about storytelling and things as you're saying that. I'm wondering how that is communicated through the generations, I guess, of people who join White.
Oh, we have this really good, so twice a year we have everyone that joins White was quietly sort of derailed since COVID, had to go to Gothenburg for 1 day or 2 days to meet the CEO, head of sustainability, some of the architects, and always one of the older team members, like a retired architect, would come in and talk about sadly, I don't think anyone that actually worked with Sydney White is around anymore. Mm. But when I started, you know, this old man comes in and said, well, I used to sit next to Sydney White, you know, to Sid, as everyone says.
Yeah.
And I think just being able to see these people that have worked within the company for so long, and we have a, you know, very strong tradition that people just, a lot of people have start at White doing their part one, which is called something else in Swedish, and then retire from White. So I think it's also, a place where people stay for a really long time because there is opportunity to develop, become a partner. Like I was told, you can do whatever you want as long as you do it well and with respect and responsibility. Obviously, it doesn't fit everyone, but I think a lot of people actually stay at White for a long time.
Linda, so coming to the end of our time with you, and it's been a lovely conversation. We were just wondering what's next for White in this. What's the legacy going to be looking back in, you know, in 10 years time? What's the next 10 years hold for White?
I think it's really going to be what is the next level of this flat structure and sharing information and ideas whilst we're entering age of more digitalization, AI, where, as we all know, what our industry, what we're focusing on is people. And I think how to manage that sort of really personal engagement within our teams and between our offices to strengthen that approach even more. And I think really not take for granted that just because we are a company that's been around for a long time, that we automatically are going to be able to build trust and respect within our teams. It's something that we obviously need to work on every day at all times. But I think it's proven that, you know, working in the way that we've been doing also, you know, brings forward much more innovation and better designs and having very mixed and sort of, you know, wide, diverse teams, whether it's across offices or across generations or across, you know, countries, is really important. So really sort of build the next level of what that collective idea is, I think.
I think that's great. It's so good to hear that sort of next iteration of something which is also is already quite progressive to go beyond that, I think is sign of a great organisation.
Yeah, it's kind of recognising that you don't have a right to continue to exist. Yeah.
As the world is shifting, it's like an organisation can never be static. So I guess it's how do we evolve within that? And what does that require in terms of leadership or being a member of a team? How can we make sure that people don't get totally exhausted because it's too much to take responsibility? And how do we, you know, trust that people do what they say they're going to do? And how do we make sure that people that actually want to lay low for a time and just, you know, work part time can feel really confident with that and still feel that they contribute as much as the others in the team?
Yeah, wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Linda. That's been such a great conversation. I think
yes, it was really good.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed
it. Thanks too.
Lots of nuggets in there for our listeners out there. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was really good. Talk to you.
Great. See you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.